Welcome to Semiobites, bite-sized podblog episodes related to theological semiotics.
Hello again, everyone who listens to Jonathan and me, Yoni and me, on our Yidbrick Semiobites podcast and some occasionally associated blog posts. Today we have a very special guest. The topic is once again on the climate crisis and related matters, and our guest is the famous and infamous Guy McPherson. So Guy, just want to turn things over to you and let you kind of make a brief intro of yourself, and then we'll kick off a conversation around your work.
Thank you both, Yoni and Terry. I somehow, despite my better wishes, have become the world's leading authority on abrupt climate change leading to near-term human extinction. And because nobody's particularly desirous to go extinct as a species or as an individual, you can imagine that not a lot of people appreciate my message. I'm a professor emeritus of conservation biology at the University of Arizona. I left active service 11 years ago this May 1st. So I left active service at the age of 49 on May 1st, 2009. And once you get caught by the research bug, by the scholarship bug, apparently it's very difficult to shake it. So I wasn't off campus for a year before I began writing my next book and began a long series of essays at my blog, Nature Bats Last, which you can find at guymcpherson.com. And so now I'm doing pretty much the same thing I was doing when I was on campus, except for a lot less pay, meaning zero, and not nearly as captive an audience as I had on campus.
Well, I will say, I do have a detailed question. How long had you taught at University of Arizona before you retired?
I was there 20 years to the day. I had taught one academic year at Texas A&M University before then. I did my postdoctoral research at the University of Georgia and received both my master's and PhD at Texas Tech University after pursuing an undergraduate degree at the University of Idaho in forestry.
Right. So you've been going back to that University of Idaho degree in forestry. You've been living the life of both firsthand and scholarly understanding of nature and its cycles and processes, right?
Oh, yes. I worked for the Nature Conservancy during a one-year leave of absence. I took sabbatical leaves at the University of California in Berkeley and also in the wilds of New Mexico, where I was the scholar in residence at the Licta Ecological Research Center on the Gila River in New Mexico. So I've spent a lot of time in the wilds in one place or another. Most recently, when I lived in Western Belize in Central America for about 2.5 years, ending in late 2018. So I really do appreciate time in nature, time in the wilderness, in the wilds, to balance the time I spend staring at the screen and hacking at a keyboard.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to kind of, as a launch into our discussion here for Yoni and me with you, I'd like to kind of focus on your latest book, Only Love Remains, Dancing at the Edge of Extinction. I love that title. And the book for our listeners is available on Amazon and elsewhere, but it's best, I think, to get it off of Guy's website and his blog at guymcpherson.com. It's out of their own imprint, Wood Thrush Publications. And it's not any more expensive, I don't think, Guy, from your site as it is from Amazon, is it?
No, it's not. In fact, my site points you right to the Amazon site. And despite all the terrible things you hear about Amazon, they actually return a far greater royalty than working with any of the few remaining large printing press shops.
I'm glad to hear that from someone else, because as it turns out, I'm doing a little bit of writing myself, and I decided I would try to do it using the Kindle kit that plugs into Word and just publish it myself. Why not?
Right.
To kick this off, one of the best quotes I've run across in the half decade I've been focused almost full time on the climate crisis came out of your book in the introduction, I think. I don't see the page number, but anyway, it reads like this, quote, acceptance of abrupt climate change leading to near-term human extinction is optional. Participation, however, is mandatory. That just, you know, that pretty much puts it in your face, you know? And I have to say, that's one of the best statements of the fact, truth, and reality of the climate crisis that I've run across. So I know the background of that a little bit around the aerosol masking effect or global dimming and how that paradox around that came into be. But could you take a few minutes and kind of explain that for Yoni and me to give me more clarity and to introduce Yoni to it and to introduce our listeners to it?
Sure. We're in the midst of abrupt, irreversible climate change. We know no means by which to either slow or stop abrupt, irreversible climate change. Donald Trump's director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, took to Capitol Hill to warn of abrupt climate change in February 2018. And of course, the notion of abrupt climate change is supported by abundant evidence, or Dan Coats would have never mentioned it. In addition, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, concluded that climate change is irreversible in September 2019. So if you put together abrupt and irreversible, I come up with abrupt, irreversible climate change. So, so if I'm doing the math right there, and I think I am, we're in the midst of a very dire situation. And there's abundant evidence, of course, presented at GuyMcPherson.com, where I provide links to many hundreds, at least, and perhaps thousands of peer-reviewed journals and the articles found within them. So this is not something I invented, unfortunately, because had I done that, I'd be backpedaling right now. Nobody more than me wants to be wrong about where we're headed, but the evidence takes me to a place that takes us to a place collectively that nobody's going to be particularly happy about.
That's been my own experience, Guy, for what it's worth. Even in the doctoral cohort that Yoni and I were in together, and everywhere pretty much outside the awake community who are aware of this reality and aren't running from it or fleeing from it, pretty much everywhere, if I start talking about it, it quickly becomes that's what you believe and you're just an irascible old fart. So, you know, we know this is just what you believe. And we know you're really just trying to build an agenda around it, yada, yada, yada. And I'm going, no, you couldn't be more wrong. I'd give anything to be wrong about this.
Absolutely.
And I can't get that reality across that I don't want to believe this.
Right.
I spent 5 years studying this and half a decade before that trying to disprove it, right? The null hypothesis, scientific approach, right? This is what I don't want to be true. But everywhere I looked, I couldn't find any evidence to support the claim that it was false.
Right. I've been studying anthropogenic climate change since the early 80s when I was in graduate school. And I was editing a book in 2002, subsequently published by the University of Arizona Press. And I can't remember the name of the book because it has some inane academic title that's stunningly dry. If I found the title and read it to you, you'd fall asleep 3 words in. In any event, I was putting together, as one of the two editors for this book, I was putting together all these contributions. So we had asked people for contributions that deal with experimental work and modeling and geomorphology, soil-plant relationships, plant-water relationships, predictions about what the future looks like, and so forth. And as I was going through all those papers in 2002, it occurred to me that we were done, that we had already crossed too many tipping points and there was no going back. Of course, I didn't open my mouth about it because I recognized the importance of lying if I wanted to maintain my privilege as a university professor. Mm-hmm. So I didn't actually bring up the topic for a few years beyond that. And in some ways, I wish I'd never had.
Yeah. And I could kind of relate to that. Yoni, do you have any questions or perspective on this at the moment?
Oh, don't worry. I plan on toss in some questions in there once I have more percolating to do.
Okay. The phrase abrupt climate change is what the center of that quote that I used. That's kind of the center of it at this point. But for those who may not get the difference, what makes the climate change issue that we're familiar with and the press occasionally will cover, what makes it abrupt? What does it mean to say that it's not just a climate change or not just a crisis, but it's an abrupt climate change and crisis?
Right. The abrupt showed up in the literature on climate change sometime in the 1990s, if I'm not mistaken. And at that time, it referred to, when writing abrupt, that referred to climate changes over generations. So looking back in time at the paleoclimatic record, people concluded that there were times in the deep past that the climate had warmed quite suddenly, the global average temperature of the planet. And by quite suddenly, they meant over hundreds or thousands of years. Now, the PETM, the Paleocene, Eocene Thermal Maximum, is relatively well studied. There's a lot of scholarly information available about it. And so it remains the gold standard for abrupt climate change, because that's the in the deep past, and in this case that's about 55 million years ago, that is the event that demonstrated a very rapid global average change in temperature in a very short period of time, and here we're talking decades. Well, we're warming the planet, we're producing carbon dioxide emissions and subsequently warming the planet more than 100 times faster than it occurred during the PETM, the Paleocene, Eocene Thermal Maximum. So that alone should give us pause. We are going a couple of orders of magnitude faster than occurred during the most rapid global average change in temperature that we have ever observed in the paleo record. So that should give one cause to hesitate and think about what we're doing. That's abrupt. That's, if the PETM was abrupt, what we're talking about now is really, really abrupt. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, you know, again, putting together a couple of pieces of information, Tim Garrett at the University of Utah has done a bunch of research indicating that civilization itself, no matter what version of civilization we're talking about, civilization itself, whether it's socialism or capitalism, or whatever road you want to go down, civilization itself is a heat engine. No matter how we power it, solar panels, wind turbines, wave power, it's all a heat engine. This set of living arrangements heats the planet. The bad news is that we now know a lot about the aerosol masking effect, sometimes called global dimming. And so what that means, if we slow down the heat engine known as civilization, we paradoxically heat the planet even faster. And that's confusing for people, so I'll take a minute to explain. At the same time, industrial activity produces greenhouse gases, and most of us know about carbon dioxide. The most common of the greenhouse gases is water vapor, but there's 41 others besides those. There's chlorofluorocarbons and nitrous oxides and a long list of greenhouse gases that, when they are in the atmosphere, they act as a greenhouse. Incoming radiation or sunlight goes through those molecules, heats up the Earth by striking the Earth, especially the darker portions of the Earth, like the blue sea, for example. And then some of that radiation doesn't escape back out into space. Some of it, particularly the long wave radiation, is trapped by those greenhouse gases, which serve as something of a blanket. Or you can think of it as your car on a sunny day when you park it on a sunny winter day in a parking lot. And you go into the store or whatever, you come back out, and the car's really warm inside. That's because the radiation came in, and some of it couldn't escape, particularly the long-wave radiation that heats the car or the planet.
And that's kind of so those greenhouse gases create what you might think of metaphorically as the blanket, that is a warming wrap.
Right. Or you, to think of it another way, as the greenhouse themselves. Those greenhouse gases form the panels on your greenhouse, that allow light in but don't allow the subsequent heat to go out. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's one side of what's been called the McPherson paradox, coined by my supporter and online acquaintance, Bill Eddy. We're warming the planet. That's one half, and most people know about that half. But the paradox comes when same time industrial activity produces those greenhouse gases, industrial activity also produces particulates, most notably aerosols, in the upper atmosphere. And those aerosols serve as an umbrella. Just as the greenhouse gases act like blankets, the aerosols act like an umbrella. And so they're up there actually reflecting incoming sunlight before it can strike the Earth. So, like, you take a parasol on a sunny day to keep the sun from sunburning your nose. And those particulates, those aerosols, many of which, probably most of which, are associated with burning poor quality coal. So the one thing that we've claimed that we want to get rid of to tackle global climate change is low quality coal, which is most of the coal. It has abundant sulfur in it. When you burn it, that puts sulfates into the atmosphere, and those sulfates are among the most dominant aerosols in the atmosphere that keep the sunlight from striking the Earth and heating it up in the first place. Those particulates fall out somewhere between 5 days, that's a figure given by James Hansen, and 6 weeks, which seems to be the consensus among other climate scientists. In any event, it doesn't really matter whether it's 5 days or 6 weeks, it falls out very rapidly, much shorter than a growing season of plants, for example, much faster than organisms can adapt to that rapid rate of change. So
there we are, actually. We're stuck right there in the paradox. It's a damned exactly. If we do, damned if we don't. If we shut down that industrial civilization heat engine to get rid of the greenhouse gases that form the blanket or the greenhouse, we will lose the umbrella, the parasol. And if we keep it going, we'll have the parasol, but we'll lose the blanket.
Right, exactly. And how fast is it going to heat up if we maintain this set of living arrangements? According to a paper by Burke and colleagues that came out in the December 26th, 2018 issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, we're headed for a Pliocene-style climate as early as 2030. Pliocene was 2 to 3 degrees Celsius warmer than we are now. So
now that's a much more dire forecast than the IPCC typically puts out, right?
Oh, yes. This is in the peer-reviewed literature. It uses the representative concentration pathways given to us by the IPCC. So I would argue it's a very conservative approach. It doesn't take into account any of the now dozens of self-reinforcing feedback loops. It does not take into account the aerosol masking effect. It, in fact, assumes a relatively slow rate of change and still gets us to the Pliocene as early as 2030 using the IPCC gradualism method.
I see. Okay.
It's pretty shocking, actually, that nobody involved with the IPCC is willing to admit that this paper, which takes the approach they designed and came up with, the representative concentration pathways, right, which have long been shown to be not nearly fast enough. That's gradualism again. And yet,
there's a hypothesis of my own I want to run by you here because I think it ties in right here. You're familiar with the shifting baseline syndrome, right?
Oh, yes.
Well, with that in mind, let me take a minute and explain what I understand of it. And what I understand of it is it came out of Daniel Pauly, some years ago, he's a fisheries guy, okay, scientist, fisheries biologist. And he noticed that over time, the populations of the fish and the health, well-being of the fish was steadily declining, but it was happening so slowly that the records in the fisheries weren't really keeping up with the change. They weren't even noticing it, because there was a baseline of that health and well-being of the fish and their size of their populations. But that baseline was shifting so slowly that it wasn't appearing in the data. Now, is that a fair summary?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and I will say personally, anecdotally, I was living in Florida back in the early 70s, 73 to 75, and I lived in West Palm Beach, and we went down to the Keys a couple of times to go deep sea fishing. And there were, you can still see this, I'm sure, if you go down there. You go to the, you know, you go to the marina, and you get a contract with a captain of a fishing vessel, and you go out to the deep sea, and you come back, and there's however many went. Everybody puts their fish up on the rack, and you show what you caught. Well, if you look at the pictures that go back to Ernest Hemingway's time in Key West, four or five guys would go out, and they'd come back with like 4 tons of fish. And there would be sea bass the size of a ski boat. And there would be flounder the size of a floor rug. I mean, massive and huge numbers of snapper and other good, you know, great fish. And this is four or five fishermen on a day trip. Then you jump ahead, I don't know, let's say 25, 30 years. And the picture almost reverses. There are more people on the boat and on the dock with their catch than there is a catch on the rack. The numbers have gone way down. The size of the fish has gone way down. And you've got 20 people standing around a rack with about 50 pounds of fish. And that, to me, was the most vivid picture of what Pauly was writing about in terms of shifting baseline.
Right. And another quick glimpse at that is to find a picture, I'm sure there are many of them online, of Ernest Hemingway. And he used to fish in that area.
Yeah.
And there'd be pictures of him. And these fish are enormous by contemporary standards. Fish from the 1950s, which is not that long ago. That's one human lifetime. And they were 10, 12 feet long then. And now people are coming on shore and they got a 18-inch long fish and they're pretty proud of themselves.
Right. And they can catch a marlin, but it's maybe going to be 3 or 4 feet tops.
Right.
And exactly. So here's my question. Here's my hypothesis, and I'd like your feedback on this. And the prime example or case study, I guess, that stands for this hypothesis is what's happening with the methane release from melting permafrost. If I read correctly, a couple of months ago, there was an article that came out that said the scientists had predicted that we wouldn't have to worry about methane from permafrost until at least the end of the century, 80 or 90 years down the road. Well, turns out they were off by 70 years because it's already happening. And it's not just happening, it's happening in a tipping point rate based on especially what they're seeing in the tundra in Russia. Well, here's what my concern is. The quality of the scientific paradigms around this climate crisis seems to be diminishing precisely because the shifting baselines in nature are accelerating. Now, does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Methane, you know, James Hansen was clearly worried about methane when his 2007 book came out, Storms of My Grandchildren. And he has consequently lost a lot of that concern, I think, unnecessarily and inappropriately. And there, I want to point out that there are two primary sources of atmospheric methane. One of them is the relatively shallow seabed of the Arctic Ocean, most notably the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, where Natalia Shkova and her research team have been conducting research for decades now. The other primary source is the permafrost melt, and that's permafrost throughout the circumboreal region, Canada, Siberia, and so on. Mm-hmm. And in both locations, there have been numerous measurements taken and numerous peer-reviewed articles published indicating that the rate of release of methane has been much more rapid than had been predicted basically ever. So, and it's not just Natalia Shkova's research team, it's Peter Wadhams's research team as well, who's studying the methane release beneath the Arctic Ocean, and the permafrost melt has been pretty well studied at this point, and the permafrost is just going away, is the bottom line. Mm-hmm. I suspect you have seen the reports, and most of your listeners have seen or heard about the reports that deal with the drunken trees. The trees are falling over so fast because the methane beneath them is melting. And so there's nothing to hold the roots in place anymore. I was on a speaking tour in Alaska about a year ago and was taken by a naturalist out into University of Alaska property. And he showed us some of those drunken trees. In addition, they had built a nice little interpretation area to show people the forest, what it looks like and what it used to look like. And they kept having to move the walkway. They have this beautiful wooden walkway, and they would plant the piers deep in the swamp until they hit permafrost. Yeah. And then they moved it 5 years later because the permafrost wasn't permanently frosty anymore. The boardwalk was falling down, and they did that. They did that three times up till last year, and it was clear that it was time to move it again because the thing was getting pretty wobbly.
Wow. Well, again, the shifting baseline here. I mean, to me, that's just the perfect poster case. The prototypical and stereotypical case with the permafrost. And what I'm concerned about is the empirical fact of it happening and the consequences that has for humankind and all life on the planet. But in the shorter term, the way it concerns me is just like it's taking away that boardwalk every year or two, it's taking away the reliability of our scientific data and the instruments we use to measure them. Right. Because those instruments are old and aging quickly. And as far as we know, on our lower rungs on the technology gap between what's happening in the military research elite and what we know from the public on the shelf, there's a big gap there, I think. So unless there's instrumentation up there that's far better than anything we're publicly able to know about, and I don't mean to put a tinfoil hat on here, but there is a gap there. But what we know publicly, just based on that, it seems to me, that the instrumentation we know about is not able to keep up anymore because the baselines have been shifting so much more rapidly. And that to me is moving toward a tipping point where we won't know what the hell's going on anymore, even with the best of our scientific data.
Absolutely. As my co-host on my radio show on the Progressive Radio Network and my dear friend Kevin Hester says, it can only be worse than we know. Nothing can be better than we know, because the scientific process of generating reliable knowledge is too slow. And in addition, there's not a government in the world that's in the business of telling the full truth to its citizenry.
Yeah, that's what concerns me about the IPCC, by the way. They have, a two-year turnaround from the time they get data and generate reports and studies?
Much longer, up to 8 years.
Yeah, and there's almost like a veto power group. The economic board or the economic contingent within the IPCC is where all the politics comes into play, I think, or most of it.
And after the report is done, it gets sent to governments of the world, and they can censor pretty much anything they want. Yeah. And so that's why it was really a watershed moment when the first few versions of the assessment through number 4 or 5, I'm trying to remember, sorry, I lose the details sometimes, indicated 2100, right? Yeah. So it always gave 2100 as the year we needed to be. We're like, we're going to make it right up till December 31st, 2099. But then in October 2018, the IPCC came out with their latest assessment, and they said 2030.
Yeah.
When you go from your first few assessments indicating 2100 is the time we should be worried, and then all of a sudden, it's 70 years earlier, and by the way, that 70 years is within the lifespan of most people on the planet right now. Yeah, that tends to get people's attention, doesn't it?
Well, no.
Not nearly as much as we like, obviously.
It gets people's attention in the communities that are awake to the reality, but it's still, I mean, let's kind of shift, look through another lens at the same issue. I'm really kind of dismayed at the response to the coronavirus. I mean, there are so many dimensions to why that is just such a frustrating thing to watch happen. I mean, just leaving aside the disease itself and its infections and more mortality and morbidity rates and all that stuff, just the phenomenon itself. And I saw a kid holding this up on a handmade sign in a photo. He was holding up a cardboard sign that said, "Mainstream media, please start covering the climate crisis the way you're covering the coronavirus.
Right.
And I'm going, yeah, let's all wait for that to happen. But so that's frustrating. And then to see the politicization, I guess, the profiteering, and I don't just mean the scamming, but the actual, I mean, how much money did Trump pour into the coronavirus, into the financial district? $1.5 trillion, you know?
Yeah,
I don't want to go too political here. I'd rather keep this on the scientific, or at least the impact of the phenomenon of the climate crisis. But it just is fascinating to me that we have this short-term view of things, and we refuse to look beyond it until we're personally experiencing it. And if people think the coronavirus, correct me if I'm wrong, but if people think the coronavirus is what it's going to be like when the climate crisis shows up, I hate to disabuse them of that illusion, but no, there's no, it's apples and oranges. It's more like rocks and I don't know. It's not even, they're such distinct categories. Comparisons are impossible.
Right. Rocks and jello. Let's go with that.
Yeah, there you go. That's close enough. That's better. So, I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, are you trying to deal with the same frustration?
Yes. And it's interesting because I suspect there is a way through to at least minimize the suffering associated with COVID-19. I don't think there's a way through. I don't think there's any solution to abrupt, irreversible climate change. So maybe it's just all part of the grand distraction. You mentioned the $1.5 trillion that the system put into Wall Street one day. Now there's talk of $1 trillion a day through the central banks of the world. That's real money.
Yeah. And, well, it's quantitative easing on steroids.
That first $1.5 million, had we given that to the people of the United States instead of to the stock market of the United States, that would have been more than $4,500 a piece for every man, woman, and child in the United States.
$1.5 trillion, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Instead of infusing that money into Wall Street, had we just written checks to every person, every legal citizen in the United States, it would have been $4,500 and change to everybody. Yeah. I think most people would have been happier about that.
I think so. Yeah, especially the ones that are getting the coronavirus.
Right. And considering that a test, if you can get one, costs about $3,000. You know, if we just did that, here's $4,500. In fact, you're going to get $1,500, and we're going to have a $3,000 test kit, and every man, woman, and child in the United States can get tested. How's that? Instead of pouring $1.5 trillion into the stock market.
Well, let me kind of, and this, believe me, this is not characteristic of me, but let me kind of rein us in on the political dimension here. Yoni knows that that's not characteristically how I would proceed from this point forward. But I do want to come back to a related question to the McPherson paradox. If the industrial heat engine pours greenhouse gases in that turns up the thermostat on that electric blanket, let's say, let's make an electric blanket so we see the greenhouse gases as the thermostat that turns it up and down. And at the same time, that heat engine opens up that parasol or umbrella that's beyond the greenhouse gas effect. And there's your paradox, right? Damned if we shut down industrialization, damned if we don't. Because of the umbrella. So my question is this, and it's, I'm sure this is a naive question, which is why I'm asking it, because I'm struggling to come up with a clear answer. If one of the proposed technologies or solution ideas around the climate crisis, as far as the greenhouse gases go, is drawdown. How much can we draw? You know, let's come up with the technology to take all these greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, or not all, but at least a reasonable amount, so that we aren't facing this crisis. I'm wondering if there isn't some sort of sweet spot, some sort of right at a tipping point where we could use drawdown technology to address the thermal blanket effect, and yet it's sustain enough industrial civilization to keep the umbrella open. You see what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. And I think there probably is. And perhaps we were operating at that level in the world up till, I don't know, the early or late 1800s?
I was going to say the late 19th to the early 20th century is when we kind of really, I mean, the slope of the curve, you have to zoom in pretty tight on the Enlightenment period, you know, right, in the 16th century, let's say, or 17th up until the 21st. You have to right, zoom in to the far right of that curve to see just how much acceleration is going on. But at exactly, the very beginning of that, I think you're right around 1900.
Yeah, there's a paper published in 1929 on the Earth's Hall masking effect. It indicated almost exactly the amount of masking from those aerosols, as pointed out by a December 2011 paper by James Hansen and colleagues. So what that means is the masking was already very important in the 1920s. And mm-hmm, so I think we would have to back up before then to start slowing things down or compensating for the aerosol masking effect. And that means a lot less people on the planet consuming a lot less material things.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I don't know a lot of people are going to vote for that, by the way.
I don't either. I'm just thinking of it as a technical and scientific design that right, in principle seems to me would have some viability.
Right.
Now, when you factor in population growth and consumerism as an economic model and capitalism as an elite economic model, et cetera, then it becomes untenable. And last but certainly not least, there's not enough time left.
Right. You know, back when I thought there was time left, that's one of the primary reasons I left active service at the University of Arizona, was to go live in an off-grid home. And that was because I thought there was enough time in 2009. I wasn't fully informed about the aerosol masking effect, so I made this grave mistake that cost me not just money and privilege, but most of the relationships in my life. Because when you do something weird, out of the normal, something that makes you not fit in, people love to hold that against you, even if they claim they won't.
Yeah. And well, try this on for size, guy. About the time you were leaving academia as a distinguished professor, I was going into academia as a sextagenarian in my 60s to get a doctorate. Mm-hmm. So anyway, go on with what you were describing there about 1900 and the viability of that drawdown and finding a balance between drawdown and industrial heat engine.
Yeah, you know, I think, again, we would have to go back to before 1920, so more than 100 years ago. And that's what I was attempting to do when I made that big personal move that turned out to be an insignificant societal move in living off-grid, and I was hoping to lead the way. And it's a good thing that a whole bunch of people didn't follow me, by the way, because then we would have lost the aerosol masking effect, right? I was living off the grid in a straw bale house and milking goats and raising chickens and ducks and geese and so on for their eggs. And it's a good thing a whole bunch of people didn't join me, or we would have lost a significant amount of the aerosol masking effect, and the Earth would have heated even faster than it was heating at the time. Right. So one more for the mistakes have been made file. It's quite a lengthy file in my case. and it just demonstrates to me that without full knowledge, you can make some really horrible mistakes, and nobody has full knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Ever. And even when we think it's full, it's still uncertain.
Of course.
Mm. So I have a question. Sure. It was actually suggested to me this week in regards to the COVID-19 situation that China is in the process of recovering from. One of the comments made was that a lot of the visible smog and pollution over the city of Wuhan seems to have dissipated. Is it possible that viruses and outbreaks might be a way to help curb our situation, especially as the permafrost continues to melt and we discover new viruses we haven't had to deal with before?
Yes, absolutely. And people are cheering, mostly people who don't know about the aerosol masking effect or global dimming. People are cheering about the incredibly clean air over China, portions of China, most notably Wuhan, as you mentioned, and also over Italy. So when you shut down the polluting system that is industrial civilization, it appears that good things happen. The canals in Venice, Italy, are cleaner than they've ever been. People are seeing fish in them, which is just an indicator of how quickly the planet will recover if we stop abusing it. But we can't afford to lose a significant portion of the aerosol masking effect for an extended period of time, or we kill every tree on the planet. And without trees, we aren't going to last long.
So is it possible? And it wouldn't matter how many trees, would it?
Is it possible to taper our response, where we slowly decrease?
It might be, and I think that's where the COVID-19 offers us an opportunity, interestingly enough. Not one that we were able to foresee, but sure, clean up Wuhan and other cities in China, and maybe if we proceed slowly enough, the masking will decline slowly enough that we have an opportunity to adapt somehow. That's the only way, that's the positive part of COVID-19, and it presents a potential way forward. I'm not particularly optimistic, and that might be because it's just part of my character to not be optimistic, but most of the papers on the aerosol masking effect continue to refer to 2100 as if that's some sort of magic number. And so when they describe, as Levy and colleagues did in their 2013 paper, they describe a reduction in the industrial activity of as little as 35% between now and 2100. Well, what we're seeing right now, and then the subsequent paper by Rosenfeld and colleagues indicates that it's somewhere around half of that 35% that could do the same trick. And so, you know, we're getting close, I think, to losing a significant portion of the aerosol masking effect globally, not just locally. And that doesn't portend a long future for most of us. And so that's why it's this damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario. And if there is a way forward through drawdown, and currently there's no known means to even draw down the interest, the additional CO2 we put up into the atmosphere every year, much less the principal of this enormous amount, 410 parts per million and change. When we started the Industrial Revolution, it was about 280 parts per million. So if we could come up with a way to draw down at very large scale, make an international effort to do so, and deal with the masking, then maybe. And that's why I'm working closely with a collection of people. The leader on the project is a Harvard engineer trying to mitigate for the aerosol masking effect. And I can't say a lot about it because it's intellectual property that doesn't belong to me. But this engineering-focused group has come up with a way, at least theoretically, to point some of the incoming sun back out into space before it has an opportunity to heat up the planet. If that works, it would give me considerably more optimism than I do now. But the guy who's leading the effort at Harvard, of course, is not given, in my opinion, nearly enough time to work on that project because he's got other things that he was hired to do. So, you know, the faculty members are assigned these little slots, and you're doing this, you're teaching this class, and you're doing this kind of research, and blah, blah, blah. And this is kind of a new thing with a person who's relatively new to the idea of the aerosol masking effect, like within the last 2 years, I guess. And so if we could get a significant amount of money pointed his way and relieve him of other responsibilities, it would give me some reason to be optimistic about that project and the path forward.
You know that moment in your television episode when you're really engaged and really into it, and there's this huge climax, and then it goes to be continued, and you have to wait for the next episode to air? Well, that's what we're doing to you right now, so we'll see you next time.
Send questions, comments, and suggestions to semiobites@gmail.com. Semio Bites is a podcast co-hosted by Yedbrick and Semio City that answers Semitic questions via Semiok analysis by addressing misunderstandings to build a bridge of shalom between Judaism and Christianity. Semio Bites is a component of the Track 2 dissertation process at Portland Seminary for Jonathan Esterman and Terry Rankins.